sometimes the things that tear us apart are the ones that unite us and bring us closer together. Sometimes the darkest tonight turns into a day so bright, leaving the scars and the pain, everything that we fear behind us. Where there is life, let's keep on dreaming. Where there is love, let's find unity. Where there is hope, keep on believing, keep on.
From Sagicor.
70 minutes after 3 o'clock, it is now time for Mental Health Matters as we say good evening to Tessa Chatterton Shaw. Good evening, ma'am.
Hi, Oliver. How are you doing this afternoon?
I'm doing good, ma'am. How are you?
I'm well. Just, you know, we had a little delay there because I wasn't expecting month in review, but we shall move on. I just want to say to all my listeners that, you know, this will be my final program for a little while. It has been a very interesting journey as we examine what I really aim to do was to highlight issues pertaining to mental health and mental wellness, to look at different psychiatric and psychological disorders, and I would have invited a wide range of guests. And the feedback has always been very uplifting and reassuring. And there's a definitely need for us to have an ongoing conversation on these issues, which are largely very much stigmatized, very taboo, and families don't like to discuss these matters. I just want to, as I started, give a definition of mental health, which is a state of well-being in which an individual realizes his or her own abilities, can cope with the normal stressors of life, can work productively and fruitfully, and is able to make a contribution to his or her community. And that is a statement from the World Health Organization. Given the seriousness and the impact of COVID-19, the World Health Organization even set up a high-level commission on mental health. And I think that is a very important step forward, because, you know, one thing that I want us to do as a people is to become comfortable with words like I'm going to see my psychiatrist or psychologist, or I have to see my therapist, I have to go for an assessment at the psychiatric hospital and not at the psyche, not at the mental. You know, changing our narrative is very important for our understanding of these issues. Today is actually a significant day across the world. June 26 is the International Day Against Drug Abuse and Illicit Trafficking, as designated by the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime. And the theme is addressing drug challenges in health and humanitarian crises. The world is facing different challenges, and the UNODC is taking steps globally to create a world free of drug abuse. The main aim of this day is to spread awareness about the physical and psychological impact of substance abuse, drug overdose deaths, and drug-related problems across the globe. Now, with me this afternoon are two very, very special guests. one a female, a recovering alcoholic. Her name is Yvonne, and one a male, David. I can think of who has been on a long journey, and both have been on very successful journeys. I think collectively they have about 60 plus years of making a serious commitment to themselves to remain drug and alcohol free. I can think of no better way to conclude this series and to recognize the International Day Against Drug Abuse by celebrating two wonderful people who have struggled, but who are in a great place today. So Yvonne, if I could, now guys, just remember that Oliver's gonna interrupt us periodically to play some ads, but I want this to be a frank, open discussion for the benefit of the public. So let's start with the lady, Yvonne. Maybe you can start by telling us. And Yvonne, I am not sure if you're muted. Are you hearing me, Yvonne?
You just have to unmute your microphone, Yvonne. Just unmute your microphone. There you go.
Yvonne, I think you're muted again.
Yeah, you're muted again.
Okay.
Yvonne, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Yes, and thank you for being here. And if you would be so kind to tell us about your journey. I believe your drug of choice was alcohol, and maybe you can start by telling us how it all began.
Will do. Yeah. I am an alcoholic, and my name is Yvonne. I had my first taste of alcohol at the age of 9, a little wine that my uncle gave me. Then I had my second drink when I was 12. And that drink, I got drunk. It was Christmas Day, and I got drunk. And then I didn't have a drink till I was 16 years old. And I had that drink, and I was an everyday drinker. And at the age of 21, I started to work in government. And I started missing work on Mondays. I would drink. And then on Mondays, I wasn't able to work. And then my weekends got longer and longer until I stayed home a whole month. And meantime, all sorts of trouble I got in, but I never once looked at the alcohol. Anything happened to me, I blame people when I fall down, get drunk and fall down. I would say I miss my step or some excuse I would give. Then eventually I started just going to doctors to get time to drink. And it went on so for 22 years. In that 22 years, I was in and out of institutions. I lost my job in 1983. That was my first attempt at the program. I went into the psychiatric hospital through my job. They sent me down there. I didn't even know that I went before the board. And they kept me for 3 weeks. And I stopped drinking for 6 months. I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous at the psychiatric hospital.
And can I interrupt you, Yvonne?
Hello?
Can I interrupt? What was it about alcohol that... What was it that propelled you to continue your use?
I recognize only in the program when I look back at myself, because the program tell me to go back before I pick up that drink. And when I look back, I saw that I was a shy person. I was very rebellious. And when I drank, I was able to tell people what I wanted to tell them. You know, it loosened my tongue.
So you lost your inhibitions.
Yes. Yes. So I would drink every day. You know, and sometimes I say things and next day people tell me, well, I say so and so, and I said, not me. Because I didn't know anything about blockouts. So I just love to drink. Up to today, I still love alcohol, but I can't drink it.
Yeah.
You know, alcohol gave me that courage to do things that I can do on my own. So I thought, you know, but the journey was rough.
What was your home life like at the time? Like, were you living with your parents? Were you living on your own?
My mom died when I was 4 years old. My mom died in England. She suffered with epilepsy. So when I was drinking and I passed out, they would say that I suffer from epilepsy too. Oh, and she died in England. So I was raised between two grandparents. But when my drinking got bad, I would say I didn't live in a home. I live in a house because all sorts of people used to be in here. You know, I tell people that I had a good government job working for money. I used to borrow money from the bank to repair my home. I never repaired, you know. I was living in a see-through house. I didn't have to open windows to look out. And a young woman, 30, 32 years old, and ain't got a blind, nothing in the old house. You know, everything I own today, own through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, that gave me my life back. It gave me a life beyond my wildest dreams. And that time that I was drinking, I tried to commit suicide 5 times because it come a time in my life when alcohol stopped working. When I was drinking to forget, I was drinking and remembering.
Yeah.
And that is when I wanted to die, because I didn't used to feel when I drink alcohol made me numb. So I didn't have any feelings. I had any emotions, you know. And in 1983, as I said, I went down to the psychiatric hospital after missing a month from work. Service commission sent me down there. And then I went back to work for 6 months. And then I came out medical on fit because I didn't able to work. I said, I only know this after I got into the program. I give up all hope. I said, if alcohol can kill me, let kill me. I said, the bus just come in your home and kill you. So if alcohol can kill me, let kill me. So the last thing I did in 1986 is lay there in front of the bus. And
you actually lay in the road in front of a bus?
Lay down right across the road, yes. And I could hear the brakes squeaking, you know. And a couple of days after that, my higher power, whom I choose to call God, intervened. He is who intervened in my life. I know this today. Because the 14th of April, 1987, I was drinking as usual that morning. I was totally insane. I was drinking white rum and chasing with colored. And when I got to the third bottle, I said I going home and take down some meat to cook for my boyfriend. And when I got home, I took out the meat and put it in the sink, and I fell upside down in the house. And I got up and made a call to the psychiatric hospital and told Dr. Bell that I'm tired being beaten by alcohol and I'm coming in. And I know, when I look back, I know that wasn't me. That was God doing for me that morning what I couldn't do for myself. And I went in that hospital. And this time I listened to the people in there. And I keep going to my meetings. After I leave the psychiatric hospital, I keep going to my meetings. After 6 months in the program, I started helping people at the same psychiatric hospital. I start working with addicts and alcoholics, sharing the little experience that I learned in the program with the fellows in Tambourine House. I started to do service. I started to share openly about things that happened to me, because as a woman out there drinking, I got abused. Sometimes I would have sex and I would know, the only way I would know that some person had sex with me is if I did the next morning. Otherwise I wouldn't know, because I didn't know anything about blockouts. I would bring in people in here, and when I come to and I see who I bring in, I would say, I'm bringing that person, you know, some old fella or something. And I would tell myself that wouldn't happen to me again. But these things kept happening until I got sober, you know. And with society, you know, when a woman out there drinking, you know, I lost all respect, all hope. In my last days of drinking, I didn't have no name. People called me all sorts of things different to Yvonne, you know. And I came into this program. I came into the program and I got back my name.
You know, so what are you saying? What are you saying, that they called you unkind names? They called you
all sorts of things. People told me that I should be from the womb to the tomb. I shouldn't be born. When my parents got me, they could get a pair of bone dice. All sorts of things. Society wasn't too kind to me, but I cannot blame society. I got to blame me. I am the first offender. And I learned this in my program. You know, today, I have back my respect. Today, I demand my respect from people. You know, today, I don't be on the streets, because I in a program that goes by attraction. I still goes to meeting. I help people. You know, and that is the key. Working with others, giving back what was so freely given to me. You know, I help so much people through the help of my higher power. I help so much addicts and alcoholics that my name is all over the world. You know, I remember going to St. Vincent and helping people down there, St. Lucia, the majority of the islands, go down there and keep marathon meetings, you know, through this blessed program. Wherever I go, I make sure I go to meeting and I carry the message of hope, because there's hope for the women and the men out there. You know, in my time, I had to go down to the psyche, because the men had no rehab, no hotel like what I have now for the men and the women. And now we have some place for the women, and the women is staying in recovery.
Yvonne, we soon have to break for an ad, but before we go to the ad, there's so much stigma and so much negativity towards the psychiatric hospital. Tell us really what goes on down there, and how can we encourage people to make better use of its services?
You know, we can't make any person do what they don't want to do. As we have a saying in the program, I can only carry the message and not the mess. You know, when I hear people talking about how they get treated at the psyche, I just let them know, had not for the psychiatric hospital, I can be where I am today. Because that's where I get my help. And that is where I found hope at that psychiatric hospital. As we say, I know what I'm going in there for. And I know at the end of the day, I come in back out. And I prefer to be on the outside looking in than to be on the inside looking out.
Right.
You know, a lot of people, this is years now, it has stigma. From the time you go down to that psychiatric hospital, people say you're mad. But in a Might Well Step program, they have a step there, step two. And you know, it said that we would be restored to sanity if we pray rightly. Now, why should you be returned to sanity if you're then mad? I know before the shadow of a doubt, I was insane. I was totally insane. And I would tell any women, and the women today, they only have to go down to psyche to get an interview, and then they go to Marina House. They may got to spend no time down in there now. But you know, some of them, they just don't want the help.
Yeah.
Or they're going to the rehab and they put on some size and they feel them ready. But I like to tell people and tell the addicts and the alcoholics that the program is a living program. It teaches us how to live one day at a time. You know, it ain't only a program that teaching us to stop drink and stop use drugs. And alcohol is a drug too. You know, it teaches how to live, how to handle situations that used to baffle us. Resentments, things like resentment is the number one killer. It kills more alcoholics and addicts than anything else. Because we hold people in mind, and sometimes the people that we holding in mind and drinking over, they don't even know. And sometimes they pass and speak to us and, but that body ain't dead. What's she speaking to me for? She know I don't like her. And all this nonsense, you know, that we do. And resentment is like drinking the poison and wishing for somebody else to die.
Yeah. Yvonne, let's just take a break because we have to recognize our sponsors, and then we'll come back to David.
The program Mental Health Matters comes to you with the kind compliments of Sagicor Financial Corporation.
Sometimes it feels the tears apart are the ones that unite us and bring us closer together. Sometimes the darkest tonight turns into a day so bright, leaving the scars and the pain, everything that we fear behind us.
From Sagicor.
20 minutes before 4 o'clock, we return to Mental Health Matters.
Yvonne, before I turn over to David, I want to ask, first of all, I should have introduced you properly, and because you said to say that you are an alcoholic in recovery and that you carry the message to those who suffer from addiction. And you're still a very powerful messenger after all of these years. Tell me something about staying away from triggers. Triggers and people, places, and things. And then we'll go to David.
Okay. When I was in the psyche, and they told me that I had to stay away from people, places, and things, it was hard. Because I told myself, these is the only people I know, the people that I drank with. The only friends I had is those rum friends. And I sober up. My house at the time was right in front of my watering hole. And it wasn't easy for me. Because I would get cravings. Now, they tell me when I got into the program that my higher power, whom I used to call God, would remove that obsession from me to drink a day at a time. But I would still get the feeling to drink. And when I get that feeling, we would call it sugar, when I get that feeling, call some person, let some person know what is going on, or postpone the drink. Tell myself I ain't gonna drink now, I would drink later. They suggest to me to use a lot of things that sweet. Members told me to keep orange juice in the fridge and Mabi. And when they get thirsty, throw out a glass of Mabi. And it was hard because I could hear the fellas in the rum shop, the glasses knocking, and the things that I loved doing there were out there doing. But I could not go in the shop. I invented that shop. Not only that, I invented a rum shops for 4 years in my early recovery. If I needed anything from the shop, I used to smoke cigarettes, but I don't smoke now. I include that in my 12-step program. And this is about 20 years now, a day at the time I start smoking cigarettes too. So I would ask some person to buy my cigarettes. And another thing, my boyfriend used to work in government. He retired now too. And when he leaving for, before he leave for work, I would go to the shop and I would buy sweets and Shirley biscuits, because when I put down the drink, I went back a child, and nuts and different things to keep in here that I won't got to go outside when he leave. I had a fear for alcohol. They tell me in the program it was a healthy fear. When I see alcohol, I would say a crossbone and skull. It is poison for me. And I would, when I felt like drinking, you know, all they would do is tell my higher power, I don't want to go back to hell. I don't want to go back into that dark pit of hell a day at a time. And they would keep postponing it. Not now, later. I would call members. At a time I had a craving of this world, till I could taste the alcohol in my mouth. And I went into an apartment. I called a taxi and went in the apartment and locked myself in there for the whole day till that craving leave me. Because I said, anytime I get a craving like that, if I didn't have money, I would have gone straight down to the psychiatric hospital. I would go into the hospital before I pick up a drink. Because for me, the drink is to die.
It was a tremendous personal struggle for you then to stay off. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, I want to, Yvonne, I just want to turn to David now. Okay. His story is a little different, but then we'll come back together and discuss some general issues. So David, I've known David for, gosh, David, 27 years and 4 months in recovery. You are chemical dependency counselor at Verdon House, and you still consider yourself to be in recovery. You've been working at Verdon House for 22 years. You're father of two, grandfather of one, and you have been married for 11 years. Your story is slightly different. And I want you to take us back to days at Combermere School.
Hello, good afternoon. My name is David. I'm a recovering addict. I started using.
Is your volume up? Because
You can't hear me?
Sounds
a little. Hold on a second. Is that better? Is that better?
No.
Yes.
No.
Good. It's not. Testing.
We can hear you. We can hear you. I'm going to turn you up to the highest volume. Let me see if we can hear you a little better, sir.
I have the highest volume there, 100.
There you go.
Okay, David, yes. Continue.
Thank you. I started using marijuana in the early days. I remember distinctly at age, I was a person that grew up in a house where my grandmother, I can go outside, so I have to kneel down in the chair at the window, look up at people playing. So when I got sat the exam and I got entrance into Kokomania School, I decided then that I would open up. So I remember at age 11, 1968-69, because I came here in 1968. And I used to buy a bag of marijuana, a small bottle of rum, and a large packet of MSC. And that was my thing every morning. That continued right through until I reached fourth form.
And the purpose of that, you said that was your breakfast every morning?
Every morning, yeah. That used to be mine because I was one of those guys that had, I used to get $5 in change. In many cities, yeah, $5 was a lot of cash. So I would move from my grandmother's home, go down with my uncle down in Nelson Street, where he lived, and I should get another $5 because I should tell them that I ain't got the cash. So I would end up with $10. So I would demand with the money. So I would purchase, buy everybody following me. And I remember I read it coming here as an A student. And I stood down in third form, second and third form, so I was too old. And I was put out of school. I was unable to go up. So I was put out of school. In the process of that, I stayed home for about a year. And my grandma didn't even know that I was out of school because I just left home for the morning, but just as close that ever going to school, but I had gone to school. I said, well, let's go out, come to the tent to come on. Because in those days, grandparents, they used to check. Nobody checked on me. I got a job on a ship about a year after, in the process of being, I got my uncle's job. And then I went to sea. And that is where now my addiction started to escalate. I drank, I went to sea, went on ships, I started to sail all over the world. And wherever the ship goes, as long as they can get shore, as long as they can dock, I would find myself shoreside. Whatever the people are doing, I never asked the name. I didn't want to know the name. All my question was, is this good stuff? And that's how I lived through the whole process of this life. That went on to...
So what type of drugs were you using at that time while you were sailing?
Most of the drugs that you used at that time was alcohol, but I used to pop pills in between, smoke a lot of weed. I love smoking weed. I smoke coca powder in Turbo, Colombia. And it didn't give me an effect, but I just smoke it because everybody doing what people do, I just get involved. And that went on. But my main drug at that time was alcohol. And in 1985, ships were made. I was made redundant. The British decided to get rid of the U.S. Indians. And I came back to Barbados and I got a job in the Ministry of Public Works. And I went in the Ministry of Public Works. And from the time I get there, my disease started again. Because I moved, I went straight in and the drink started and everything started all over again. And I worked at MTDW, and in 1987, Easter bank holiday of 1987, I shook hands with the devil, a drug called crack cocaine. And I remember I was on a Belgian Queen, on a Tiger II cruise, came off the ship. Belgian Queen had one of the best rum punches in this area. Came off the ship. Right, I had this girl in St. James, right by this girl's house. the morning about 7 o'clock. No, I never left the ship about 4. About 7 o'clock in the morning, she came and she was naked. I actually was naked, trying to get, I can't remember if I fall off the bed, ever get off the bed or whatever, but I was trying to get back onto the bed. So she came and she met me up and she told me, you need to get up and get dressed. How are you going to come and wake up me after being so high, 3 hours after it passed? That was stress. So the whole house went, they were wired. She called the police and I left the house. I had about 100 and change. This is 1987. I had 100 and change. Eastern by also. I left from there, proceed to Bridgetown Church Village. And I met this girl that I knew from everything. So I said she comes to the party. Quite vexed now, my head wild, drink still in it. And she said, you want a party? Try this thing here, man. This is my party girl. So she started this glass, foil, ash, and everything. And in those days, the dope stone, it cost $10. So she put all the dope stone, I melt it, and then I get her a tag. So she tell me, man, you waste my thing, man. So I took out some of the cash I had and said, she want to buy some. And when she come back and she stands up again, that is when I get the message. 7 years, crack cocaine. And within that 7 years, I lied, cheat. I took things. I remember I start staying up from work. And it got a point that I used to work. Rather than go work on Mondays, I would go work Tuesdays. Then it moved from Tuesdays to Wednesdays. Then it moved to weekly. Then I would go to the public health clinic to get a medical certificate to cover the time. And that went on for a period of time. And
so are you saying that your drug addiction had reached a point where you were like chronically ill and could not function at work?
Exactly. Not, I think really chronic and not functioning, the fact that I didn't have the time for work, my interest was to get high. So I gonna use, I will use all night. And in the morning, you're gonna get up, all I want is more dope. So work I got to wear, I got to look to get high. So that was the whole process. My life became unmanageable. I didn't want anything that was proper, anything that was beneficial, that was out of the door. My aim was to get high. And what I did, I was to get my money on Thursday evening, ready to pay a master for the package to pay Friday. I would go up, buy the accountant. I got a couple of friends there. I would carry a couple of bottles of rum, give them the rum, and I would get my paycheck. Friday morning, I went. And you only send me at work, not to be the next 2 years or so. So that went on for a period of time. And then it gets to the point that I started to cuss the bosses at work. I started getting in a fight. I remember time I get so drunk, I went wrong playing on a little short man. Short little man, they were showing me going so hard. And I started to get like, you know, it was like people, I started to become the scam. I started to become like, people started to call me Parole, the prickled dog. All sorts of names people started to give to me. And I went in treatment in 1993. And then I went there because the job, it went to the human resource manager and he called me in and he told me, listen, you want help. So I went down, I used to get PLS at work and that run for 6 weeks. Every weekend I'd come out, I just smoke dope. Every weekend. I would smoke up on a Friday evening, starter, stop Sunday, and go back to the group joining me. Don't smoke during it because I won't call it a high control. It's just that I didn't want to complete. So I'm trying to force myself to steal. Then I went back on. You've only done that 3 months, that 6 weeks done. I went back in again in 94. And then St. Joseph Hospital, then I had no people down there, down there was empty. So they took up 10 of us from Tamil Hill, and I went down there. I was one in 10. I spent 4 weeks. And then from there, I remember on leaving St. Joseph Hospital, I didn't owe a man some cash. And I convinced, there were two members with me. And I convinced these two members that I got to pay this man. Then I pay the man, I tell the man, listen, this is yours, I get this boy one, and I come back. And they drop me home, and I stand to my lovers at the time. And I watch to rent the left. And at the left, I went and I get my door and I start fresh again. But in 1995, the 16th of February, that was when I had my God at that time, he decided, well, look, you had enough. I got in the dog hole about 130, about 300 and change. 10 o'clock in the night, I had nothing. Same clothes I had on from work, I still had them on. And I walked, came out the dog house, came up in the road, and I tell myself, bad alert, you see me? I really needed them. And I walked from there, going to Black Rock. I stopped in Robert Street, outside of Greenfield. And I had this girl that I just walked in. And she said, MTW man, come in, man. I just really got nothing. She said, hold on, man. But she went in to get dope to bring back. Again, God with me. I moved. And I make another stop in Queen Victoria Road, by home. And this man had 3 peaches and a glass in the fridge. And I ate the 3 peaches. I just buy this one. He said no. And he moved again. I had 2 quarts in my pocket. It was about close to 12 o'clock because the service station at the top of Deacon's Road was closed. And I jumped my 2 quarts through the door. I take my one pocket, the clip. And he gave me the clip. And I walked right down to Black Rock, and I was outside by the bus pole. I ate those biscuits in one. And the mosquitoes, an army of mosquitoes started coming, and they got up and they ran up my door. And the man was working, he knew me. And I came right in. The morning, I went to Dr. Barrister Gordon, Richard Grimm. And she said, but you turned at me, you know. I tell you, madam, I don't want to ever leave here. I do not know what I'm going to do. Now, within that space, on that particular day, the space I was in, I don't know if she had ignored me and I had to come back out, I might not have been here. Because I was at the point, the crack, the alcohol, the nothing thing working. And all I do, sometimes, whether I don't want to get high, and sometimes I'm just sorry to get high because I just feel worse wanting to get high than really actually get high. So it started to play my head. So she admitted me.
At what point would you say you hit rock bottom?
Before you get to that, my friend, we have to take a short break. The program Mental Health Matters comes to you with the kind compliments of Sagicor Financial Corporation.
Sometimes I think that tears apart. Closer together. Where there's life, let's keep on dreaming. Where there's love, let's find you meaning. Where there's hope, keep on believing.
A message from Sagicor.
4 o'clock in Barbados, we return to the program Mental Health Matters.
Right. David, we were talking about your rock bottom.
Right.
I remember you sharing an experience with me about a Christmas.
Yes. 1994, Christmas, the month of December, a couple of weeks before Christmas, I wanted, now, I got back up shortly before that. By this time, I ain't got nothing in my house. TV gone, chairs gone, bed gone, fridge, everything gone. So I got a 5-piece dinette set, 4 chairs and a table. That only remained in here to the fact that nobody didn't want to buy. That was that I had that. So what I did.
Are you saying to us that you sold those items for your health
everything,
habit?
Everything. My own sister, that's all. I wanted Christmas coming up and I wanted some money. So I went to the Royal Bank where I was borrowing money all the time. And they tell me, well, I can't lend anymore. So I moved from the Royal Bank and I went across the road to the Cabin Commercial Bank. And I met this woman, this loan officer. I said, madam, my girlfriend is in hospital right now and she's going to give birth to a baby. I don't have no money. I can't buy nothing. And I need some money just to get her thing. The woman paid off the Royal Bank and put $1,500 in my hand in cash. Hard $100, brand new in my hand. I go on in town. I buy Christmas things, like chicken and whatever. I pay up the house and everything. And I decided, this where's that lever now? I can use this here and party. I smoke out the rest of my day I had and turn around and sell all the food stuff, everything. I buy for $15. I sell at $2 and $5 and all sorts of things. Christmas morning of 1994, I sat down on my step and all I can smell is the people ham and the sweet bread and the pudding, and all I can do is just inhale it all and swallow. And that morning, that there water come from my eyes. I can show you how powerful this disease is. All of that went down. And about a couple hours after that, a man come and showed me, see, I got to say here, you know that I forgot about that, yeah? Mm-hmm. That was the power of the disease, the power of this addiction. And that went on in 1994. I remember a time, and the Yvonne that is there, she is my sponsor, right? I remember a time, many years ago, I was going up on the pipe. And Yvonne called me, right? Just tell me something. And I said, hello? This is Yvonne. I said, hold on. I have not got back to that phone as yet. You know what I'm saying? So I put she from hold and forget she had the phone and everything. So in 1995.
Wait, are we hearing that Yvonne was pivotal in your transformation?
Yes. Yvonne brought me to. Yvonne was one of the persons that. Yvonne, I like Yvonne's story. Yvonne was a person, and I belong to a trust that. Fellowship to call Narcotics Anonymous. It is just a fellowship to Narcotics Anonymous. And I remember they just said to me, when you get in with you get a sponsor, get some boys that you're get for it. Yvonne ain't really smart to work, but she behaves like a crackhead. And I, when Yvonne started to talk, I said, this woman really sick here. So I started to gravitate towards Yvonne. And they asked her to sponsor me. And she had a lot to do with me in the process of my recovery. Now, there are other few members that I can't call them names right now, but there were other few members, them know who we're talking about, that also play a part. But at the process of that, going into that, the morning of the 17th of February, I sat on grass field. And a mental patient passed, and they asked him for. I said, you got cigarettes? And he said, yes. He gave me one. I took the cigarette, lit it. I smoked half of it, and I cut the other half. And I have not smoked cigarettes since then up to this day. And one of the reasons why I did that, right, nicotine, alcohol, whatever drugs they use all come as a package. So I had to get rid of that there too. So I everything I got now, everything you just mentioned, my job, my home, family, wife, children, grandchildren, whatever, all those things come through the fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous. That is what got me here today. I still go to meetings. I still actively involved. I cannot, as I always keep saying, I am in recovery on the day day. So this is what I do. My motto on the 17th of February 1995 was this: to use is to die. I got that foremost up to this day. And it has not gone nowhere. It's not going nowhere. And if you talk about triggers, my personality had a lot to do with me not being getting involved in where people would come around me and tell me where you want to bug this, because I got a personality that people just afraid of it. I remember I came out of treatment. It was the second week. I'm going back down to Black Rock. And this fellow, the Irish boy, right? I walk into him across a pasture. And he said, how you going? I said, good, man. I said, man, but you know, I'm doing nothing. He said, man, I got some big ones here. So I walk, right? And then the man tell me, you see, I got a TV now, though. I turn back, right? Then I will not tell you what I said to man. Then I just copy that man. Right? That thought he, right? Up to this day, from that day, that man has never come around the river until he got big, he got small, or he got in between. Because the message that I give to him, he get to understand that anytime he comes me again, it will not be as pleasant as what I said that day. So I got a personality that keeps me. It kind of, some people don't really appreciate it, some people don't like it. It really does not matter to the other world.
I have some general questions for y'all because the time goes so quickly. But what concerns do you have about the messages from the beverage alcohol industry, given all that you have been through and alcohol? You know, the only day that we recognize it as an intoxicating liquor is on election day. What do you think? Why don't we get it that it does cause great harm?
If you want to go on, or you want me to go on?
Either of you.
Okay. Hey, for me, right, people in the alcoholic, in the alcohol industry, right, it's about business. It is business. And I really just don't get the, see, you will get the rum distillery sponsoring this and sponsoring that. Sponsoring, in my opinion, is basically because it's a much sponsor and they get promotion so they can still make money. Everything is about cash. Alcohol is number one killing drug in the world. It is legal. And you got a lot of people in these days. Alcohol is so the consumption. You got young people going to school, teenagers drinking alcohol, carrying school alcohol. They got all these new drinks don't come in that ain't too for sharing with names. But at the end of the day, my question is, the people that are selling or making alcohol, are they interested in we in us? Now, we are people, I am a person that cannot use alcohol in any form. So
many of us don't even realize that there's alcohol in certain mouthwashes,
in sure bitters, 44.7% alcohol, great water, Listerine, all those things contain alcohol. And one thing that I do on a daily basis, right? Whenever I go into the supermarket and I see something that I am not familiar with, I read the fine print. The fine print says X, Y, Z. And that helps me get through, because I ever come at your house, right? You can't go in the back and bring up every other glass of water, or you can't go in the back and bring the water, you know. I need to see where it's coming from, or I will drink from the pot. Because again, I got to be mindful of people, places, and things. Not only, it doesn't matter where the people places, to keep from them. Also, people places that where you're going, but certain people, certain places, you got to be mindful of these people. Because some people like to test you and see, well, let me get a little thing here and let me see how you respond. So those I'd be very skeptical, and I got a problem. Trusting is a very serious issue where I am.
Yeah, I want to ask Yvonne a question. Yvonne, people, yes, who please, are struggling with alcoholism, or even from other drugs like what David described, what coping mechanisms can they use, especially at times like of festivals, like we are on the eve of crop over and Christmas and Easter, you know?
Yvonne, before you get to your reply, I'll allow you to think on it for a moment. We just have some time to remind you that the program Mental Health Matters comes to you with the kind compliments of Sagicor Financial Corporation.
Sometimes the things that tear us apart are the ones that unite us and bring us closer together. Where there's life, let's keep on dreaming. Where there's love, let's find you meaning. Where there's hope, keep on believing. Keep on.
A message from Sagicor.
And we are back live with Mental Health Matters.
Yes, Yvonne. So with festivals, yes, and all of that, I mean, like, and people are struggling. What do you advise people to do? I mean, can't we not have a good time without alcohol?
Sure. I just enjoy my life today without alcohol. I know I cannot drink. Will stop. I can't. You know, and if people will, because the advertisement around crop over and Christmas, very pretty advertisements. But what the alcoholic should look and see, that the people that advertising alcohol, you don't see them drink it. They don't drink it. You know. But we just be in something called denial. You know, and we have a disease. Alcoholism is a disease of the mind. And we have a lot of enablers. They say, well, my son ain't that bad, or my daughter ain't that bad. You know, so I drank a little too much last night, but he or she gonna be all right. You know. And when we have when I had the enablers, my aunt and all them that used to enable me, I would be in and out of the psyche and continue drinking. But when I burnt all of my bridges, I had to sober up. Because when I was in that mental hospital, nobody come and look for me. Nobody ain't bring anything for me. You know, and I remembered, and it is something that keeping me sober up to today. A fella in the psychiatric hospital, a sharp fella, just gave the ladies a flower. And I was in there and I didn't able to buy a cigarette. And I asked this fella, because scarcely talk properly, I said that, you want a cigarette? And he make a notion to me, tell me, bring the shame. And I tell myself, look at what he come to, a madman. Telling me 25 cents for a cigarette. You know, so when I remember these things, they can got crop over Christmas. I am not going to drink. I travel. I go cruising, and so much alcohol is beyond those cruise ships. And I don't drink. Every morning for the last 35 years, I turn my disease over to my higher power. And at the end of the day, I thank him that I had a drink. And I got to do that because my disease is powerful, cunning, baffling, and powerful. You know, without help, it is too much for us. But we can only carry the message. The young people out there, I work at Verdon for 20 years. And I retire in 2020 because the young people of today don't have no fear for drugs, nor alcohol, another drug. They don't have no fear. You tell them keep from people, places, and things. They go to Oyston, they get this place, the next day, they don't have no fear. But in my day, we had a lot of fear. You know, so
do you think it has...
Tell them, we could only suggest, but we can't make nobody do nothing.
Yeah. Do you think it has to
hit the wrong bottom?
Do you think it has to do with poor parenting or lack of parenting, lack of guidance, supervision, parents setting wrong examples?
This disease ain't nothing to do with that. We have people come up in good homes. Then we got people that come up on the streets. And you know what is happening? Person, the intellectual, self-sufficient man and woman is the hardest to get this program. It is too simple. Just don't take one drink one day at a time. Pray. It is too simple for them. So they pick the pieces, the program. Yeah. You know, I think that the disease don't care about color, creed. I didn't care who your parents is. It treat all of us the same way. We just lose a young fella there. We just lose one of our members. You know,
yes.
Alcohol burn out the liver, kill the brain cells. All sorts of things. People don't believe this. You know, the society, they say that somebody put a saw. And the boy that put a saw dead. Because just like how I didn't understand about the disease of addiction, society don't understand it. So we can't blame them.
Yeah. Talk to me. Well, both of you can add, you know, your comments to this. Talk to me about the 12 steps and those powerful statements that really guide you to return to that state of recovery and good health.
The first step, which is step one, is to admit and accept. Don't only admit, because if I in a rum shop or somebody said, "Why are you drinking so much?" Because I'm an alcoholic, and it didn't mean anything. But when I came back into the program, I had to accept the fact that I cannot eat alcohol nor drink it a day at a time. I can't. You see, people put alcohol in all sorts of things. You got shandy, all sorts of things. And like David said, not too long. No person can open a drink for me behind my back. I got to see it because I remember what I used to do to people. You know, so step one is admitting that we powerless over our addiction and our lives have become unmanageable. And that is the first step. And the second one is came to believe that a power greater than ourselves to restore us to sanity. And number three is made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand him. Because they have something said, the ABC, that no human power could relieve me of my addiction. No human power. You know, so I had to get somebody more powerful than myself or the drug of my choice. And that person is God. In our program, G-O-D stands for good orderly direction. Because the people that wrote these books knew that when we get to this program, we didn't even believe in God. You know, I recognize that alcohol was my God, my everything. So when they came into the program, then I had to get somebody more powerful than the drug of my choice. Or nothing would be back out there drinking. Because when I came in and I start to remember all those wrong things I did out there and those bad things, if I didn't have a higher power in my life, I would have gone back through the gate.
You know, what are the steps? Sorry, yeah. David, are there other steps?
Yes, step four.
Go ahead,
David.
Because I find whenever I read these steps, they're very spiritual.
Step four is making up fearless and searching the fearless
moral inventory.
Mm. And this is basically, let me break it down for the people that might be hearing. It's like you come from outside, you're going to need a church to get baptized. So you've got this, they call it confession. So it's about dealing with self first. Never we stop people do this and people do that. The majority of people that do us things that do me the everything is the things I do that cause the reaction. Step five is I call out the freedom step from four, the unlocking. Because they tell me to admit to God already know, I already know, but they tell me to get a human being and share my fight with this human being. And that is there is a lot of people want to do step one, two, and one. But when they come to three and four, they don't, something's just back up and left, right? And the talk about the effect of characters, right? Seven, how many hours did you remove your shortcomings? Get these things that up front for the, that's the thing that come in front of the noise that you want to deal with, the simple things, them things first, right? Then here, they tell me to make a list of all the people I have. Make this list. Nine, the list that I made in here, nine now I'm going to start to make my amends. Now,
saying sorry to those amends. People you hurt.
No, hold a minute. Mm-mm. Mm-mm. Saying amends, right? Making amends. You make amends, but sometimes they got amends called financial amends. Have you ever met more time from you or anything about or something? When it comes to make amends, I need to got your money. Not just come and say that I can't pay. You know what I'm saying? So amends is right there. And then they got a part in step nine. You got direct amends and indirect. Because you got some people that you might. Or I may have got a friend and I may have rent my house and may have got a ring, something valuable and I can't wear. And I bring down the heaven to the earth that I can't wear. And I got the right mindful how I'm making that amend to that individual because he may not let me to take it. And then it may come to a kind of person. I said, well, make it amend, but I got a point of where to deal with that. And step 10, you talk about taking a personal inventory. So this is what I do at night. Before I tell my day, I run through my day and actually see the prop, what day, blah, blah, blah. And then I put it to God and then ask for what I did, I look at and try not to do it again. So those are the things that I do on a daily inventory. Look at myself, looking at the behavior that I may exhibit during the day, how I get with it. Because we do the different, all these things in step 10. 11, that is where the prayer and meditation is very important to help you to motivate yourself to go through that, the move forward in life. And in step 12, from 1 to 11, when you get to 12, that's where you should have this personal awakening. This is where I carry the message. This is where that I come out, share. This is where that I am able to. I am at a place now where that I will be able to manage certain things. I'm not saying that I'm perfect. I will never be perfect, but I got a better understanding of how my life is. So those 12 steps, are this is what I live by. And one thing quickly say, the steps, I remember when I first came into treatment. I start my steps very early. I was eager to get this thing done. And it is so when you really get involved in that, and I Yvonne and I have done that work to called really call it step study. And this where we live. We need to focus on these steps that are important. That is the spiritual aspect. And this addiction affects us, affects the mind, called body and spirit. So it's 3-4. So when you fix, you're gonna fix all three. You can't fix two. And the majority of people that go into treatment, as Yvonne said, these people feel that they've got more, that they can handle this thing, you know. Then people feel that they can control it. So the going to treatment, look good, feel good, and in a month or two, I'm ready to roll. And when you're ready to roll now, and the tobacco, bam. Because...
All right. I need to interrupt you because time is going so fast and Oliver gave us until 4:30. But I have two questions and you could take, either of you could take one. A parent listening to this, a parent who has an adolescent or even an adult family member who is struggling with drugs, illegal drugs, or struggling with alcohol, what should they do next? Either of you can take that. And then I want to ask, are treatment services adequate in Barbados?
Yvonne, go first.
Yvonne, you want to talk about where does an individual turn to for help when they recognize, I need to change my behavior, I need to change my drug-taking habits?
As I said before, sometimes the alcoholic and the parent in denial. You know, sometimes I would just say something. We had a young member came into recovery. She was only 16 years old. And her mom said she wasn't an alcoholic. You know, not my daughter. So sometimes these parents, sometimes the parents, because they don't know nothing about the disease, sometimes them see the signs, but you dismiss it. Nah, this ain't happening. This ain't happening to my daughter or my son. And sometimes by the addicts, and we saw manipulative and things like that there, that we tell bare lies and tell the parents nothing ain't wrong with me. And you see, the thing is, again, the parent cannot make the child go to treatment, because we can't do this program for nobody. So but sometimes people will call me and tell me, well, the daughter or the son has a problem, if I could help them. I said, I would ask the question, is your daughter or your son willing to get the help?
Okay.
Can I make so, them?
So there has to be an inner recognition that...
There has to be an intervention. Sometimes that, you have to get somebody from outside to come in and talk to the patient.
Yeah. David, what about
share their experience, share a little about themselves with this person?
Yeah. David, what about treatment services? Does Barbados offer adequate drug treatment services for various populations in the country?
Yeah. Burner House is what the treatment facility at Vernon is excellent. Do not care, it does not matter how good a treatment facility is, it still comes down to the client at the end of the day. I say that because Vernon offer a variety of things. And we work hard, we work well, we give what has to be dealt with that individual. We give the individual the tools, the knowledge. However, at the end of the day, if that individual does not make use of it, it does not matter. So you cannot blame the facility. You can't blame the treatment facility, the treatment entity. It all ends up at the client. The client is who is the person that has to do
okay.
what he has to do.
All right. Now, I have, unfortunately, to bring this program to a close. I just want to thank you sincerely from the depths of my heart for sharing your very personal stories with us. It has not, I know it has not been an easy struggle, but y'all play a tremendous role in mentoring and being buddies and sponsors for other people. I cannot thank you enough for being here today. And I also want to say sincere gratitude to SagiCor for sponsoring this program for the last 2 months, for demonstrating its corporate social responsibility, where mental health, many of us, we haven't even talked yet, David and Yvonne, about COVID and its impact on substance abuse. Mm-hmm. So hopefully we can continue at some time, but I want to wish you God's blessings and continued success in your recovery, because you have tremendous stories to tell. Okay. And Oliver, thank you. You have been my faithful anchor in terms of handling the technical side of things. But I just want to say thank you. Thank you. Thank
you. It's been a pleasure, ma'am.
Thank you too.
Goodbye, Yvonne. Goodbye, David. Continue to serve others and to help others in their path, one day at a time.
By God's grace.
One day at a time.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And the preceding program, Mental Health Matters, came to you with the kind compliments of SagiCor Financial Corporation.
Sometimes it feels that tears apart. Closer together. Where there is life, let's keep on dreaming. Where there is love, let's find you meaning. Where there is hope, keep on believing. Keep on.
A message from SagiCor.